ecojusticeradio.org and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Living Minerals of Chile's Atacama, Ecosystems versus Mining. Thank you to Javiera Barandiaran and Iyapu for the musical interludes. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer and host, myself, Jack Eyte, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barasonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
Are we in the final years of human civilization? Are Homo sapiens doomed to extinction? Julian Cribb is a science writer who's looked at these questions in many of the books he's written with titles like The Coming Famine, Poisoned Planet, and Food or War. His latest book, How to Fix a Broken Planet, strikes a more hopeful tone. Julian, welcome.
Thank you.
You co-founded the Council for the Human Future, an organization that identifies 10 interrelated catastrophic risks for humanity. They are eco-breakdown and extinction, resource scarcity, hothouse earth, the nuclear threat, food risks, global poisoning, pandemic disease, overpopulation, uncontrollable technologies, and my favorite, mass delusion. I don't think we're going to be able to cover all of them in half an hour, and I'd like to focus on possible solutions. So one of the solutions you write about is changing our system of agriculture, and I think that's a good place to start because of the interconnectedness of the problems. How many of these risks are associated with food production?
Well, nearly all of them, in fact, because humanity cannot survive without an adequate and ongoing food supply. That's absolutely axiomatic. No civilization survives if its food supply collapses. And ours is now in danger of collapsing. So we've got to do something about it. And the answer is not hard to find. And let me just say, I'm an agricultural journalist. I've been writing about farming and food production for over 50 years. And I've been in many, many countries around the world looking at their agricultures. And so I do know something about this area. I've written a couple of books on how we do it. And the answer, quite simply, is the same as it is for energy. Renewable food. That is food that does not take it out of the planet to produce. It's food that can be produced again and again and again by simply recycling the nutrients and the water. It's already being done in some places. In big cities around the world, people are starting to recycle nutrients in big hydroponic farms and places like that. So it's possible to replace a very considerable proportion of the destructive process, which is agriculture, with renewable food, which is food mainly produced in cities or in the environs of cities, close to where it's eaten. Renewable food is actually a very exciting dimension. And let me add to that, we eat roughly 300 different plant foods, we human beings. There are 30,000 edible plants on planet Earth. So there is a huge diversity of culinary opportunities ahead of us if we really start going into renewable food.
Can you talk a little bit more about where you've seen the urban agriculture and how that works?
Yeah, well, you can see it in New York. You can see it in practically every city. There's a lot of it on the west coast of the United States, but there's urban farms in Gaza. There's urban farms in Montreal. There's urban farms in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. There's urban farms going up in all around Africa. And basically what these farms do is they take the wasted nutrients, the old food that's being thrown away in the garbage tip or into the sewer, and they take the nutrients back out of it and they reuse those nutrients. Because the nutrients are eternal. At the atomic level, they never break down. You can use phosphorus, you can use nitrogen and all the other micronutrients again and again and again and again, and you will never run out. At the moment, we have a mining system to feed ourselves, where we have to mine phosphorus or potash or something like that to grow crops. And then we mine the soil to grow those crops. And it makes a big mess of the landscape and it destroys nature. It cuts down forests, things like that. Renewable food doesn't do that. So you're growing renewable food at the moment on the tops of hospitals. People are doing it in their backyards in a very small way. Restaurants are already producing fresh salad on the roofs of the restaurants that they can serve 15 minutes later to their patrons. So there's a lot of exciting developments going on in this space. Probably the biggest and the most important aspect of it is that cellular food production, that is synthetic meat, all these things that are so controversial now, they're going to be commonplace in 10 or 20 years' time. We won't be eating animals. We'll be eating meat that has been grown in a large plant, in a bioreactor. It is real meat, but it's never been through a cow, as it were. The cow has been taken out of the process. And people are going to eat it because they don't know what's in a sausage or a meat pie now, do they? They don't know what's in a crab stick. People do not know what they're eating at the present time. How do I know that they're going to eat it? Well, synthetic food is like synthetic clothing. Nobody wanted to wear it back in the 1950s and 60s. And then it came in as military uniforms. And now everybody in the world is wearing plastic. If you can have a conversion like that in the clothing area, of course you can have a conversion like that in the food area.
Doesn't that make you wonder what problems are hatching in the background that we're not aware of? Like the synthetic clothing is a really good example of nobody expected it to turn into microplastics that are now in our brains. Doesn't something like this artificial meat sound like the kind of thing that maybe we should study this a little bit more?
I agree. We should make no technological changes that we have not looked at for human and environmental safety. And that is the problem, that we're trying to solve problems like climate change and so on with one-off fixes, band-aid fixes, as we call them. We're not thinking ahead enough and doing enough tests. I mean, nearly all of the chemicals, there's 350,000 human chemicals, nearly all of those have not been tested for human safety. They're just being used, they're being sprayed around, they're being emitted by industry, you know, willy-nilly and without any control. And in places like the USA, you're actually getting rid of your environmental laws as we speak, so that more people are going to die as a result of chemical poisoning in the US, as a result of what Trump is now doing with the environmental laws. The problem with humans is we only wake up to the dangers of something when it's already a bit too late. Plastics, as nobody was worried about them 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Now everybody is terrified, and with good reason. But the solution to plastics is the same as the solution to climate. And it's the same as the solution to poisoning. Get rid of fossil fuels.
Regenerative farming, how is that different from organic farming?
It's not very different from organic farming at all. Regen farmers, generally speaking, are looking after their landscapes. They're putting back the trees. They're allowing nature to come back into the farm. They're allowing the insects to do the pollination. They're allowing other insects to predate on the insects that plague their crops. It's a more holistic thing, perhaps, than just straight organic. Farming is basically just trying to avoid petrochemicals. But regenerative agriculture pays much more attention to what's in the soil. The soil is the basis of all nutrients. Everything that we eat comes out of the soil. You've got to have a farming system that unlocks those nutrients and releases them into the food supply for you to have a healthy diet. It's a huge movement worldwide. It's in America, it's in Australia, it's in New Zealand, it's in Britain, it's in India, it's in Japan. It's sweeping the world at the moment. It is basically farmers who do not want to destroy the agricultural ecosystem that supports their industry. And it's very laudable. It's not a complete solution because it's still vulnerable to climate. Urban food production is climate proof because it all takes place indoors. That is one advantage of urban food production. But regen can actually restore the landscape back to what it was perhaps in the 18th or 19th century. It can allow the end of the sixth extinction, provided we idle about half the world's farmland, which we can do. If we adopt renewable food, it's going to produce 100% of the world's food. It is, as I say, it's regenerative agriculture, it's urban food production, and it is deep ocean aquaculture. So you've got big farms in the middle of the Pacific Ocean going down a kilometer, and they're producing an enormous quantity of food. So that combination allows you to rewild an area the size of North America. That is the amount of country that you could take out of farming now and turn back into forest and grassland, and you could end the sixth extinction. But you won't just end the sixth extinction. If you have a renewable world food supply, you will take away the primary cause of two-thirds of the wars on this planet. So you will have a huge instrument for peacemaking. Renewable food is a huge way of avoiding conflict, because what do humans fight over? They fight over national boundaries. What do national boundaries embrace? They embrace food production. So of all the wars that have taken place since the American Civil War, more than two-thirds have been fought over food, land, and water. If you have a sustainable food production that provides everybody with a good diet, then you actually take away the cause of two-thirds of the world's conflicts.
Wouldn't deep water agriculture require a lot of energy?
Absolutely not, no. It's a brilliant idea. A lot of it, the work is being done at the University of California at Berkeley. Imagine a huge raft that is floating just under the surface of the ocean, where it is basically immune from storms and hurricanes, typhoons and things. And that raft is supporting a huge growth of vegetation, what we call seaweeds, but are in fact sea crops. So you could grow an enormous pasture, if you like, of sea plants. How do you grow those? Well, basically what you do is you stick a tube down into the deep ocean, about a kilometer down, kilometer and a half. And if you bring water up from that depth, it has a higher level of nutrients than water at the surface. And those nutrients can be used to irrigate crops on the surface. Now, the crops can then be used to feed grazing fishes. That's fishes like anchovies and sardines and pilchards. And those grazing fishes can in turn be then used to feed snappers and tuna and meat-eating fishes. So you can have a complete agricultural system or aquacultural system, plants, grazing fishes, and predatory fishes, all in the one thing. Now, we could do this around our old oil rigs. We've got all these old oil rigs around the world that are going to have no use within 20 or 30 years because oil will be not wanted any longer. They can form the core of these enormous ocean-based farms. A lot of the energy for them can come from either wave action or from sunlight or from wind, because you could stick big fans on them, or you could stick solar collectors, or you can float solar collectors on the ocean. There's all sorts of ways of doing this. The farms do not need to import energy from the land. They simply produce food for the land, and they can produce, I've calculated, about one-third of the world's food needs. And if you do that, if you produce a third of the world's new food needs in the deep oceans, then you basically can replace an awful lot of very destructive agriculture on land.
So the idea is that you grow this seaweed, this underwater crops, that feeds the small fishes, and then the large fish are harvested, or all of it's harvested at some point. The plant matter, the small fish, the larger fish, is that the way it works?
Absolutely. All of it is harvested because seaweed is a tremendously nutritious product. If you drink beer, eat cheese, shave with shaving cream, they've all got seaweed agar. Seaweed is a tremendously useful crop, but it's a fabulous food crop, as the Japanese have known for centuries. But the rest of the world has still got to grow up to learn to eat it on a regular basis. All sorts of seagrasses, all kinds of things can make edible food or fodder for animals or just simply fertilizer. Microalgae, tremendous potential source of nutrition. And if you want to do so, you can extract fresh oil from algae to fly aeroplanes or drive cars or whatever. This production system really offers an absolute revolution in how humans do things. And countless jobs, countless opportunities in terms of different diets and meals and things that we've never seen before or dreamed of in our menus and our restaurants and our kitchens. Very exciting. But let me explain to you why it's so potentially big. If you have a square kilometre of land, you can only graze a certain number of cattle on that, or a certain number of sheep and goats. But if you have a square kilometre of ocean, it can actually be a cubic kilometre of ocean. So you can produce a vast amount more food in a square kilometre of ocean than you can in a square kilometre of land. Probably 10 or 20 times more food, maybe even 100 times more food from an ocean farm than you could produce from a land farm. You don't need a lot of these things. They don't need to take up a lot of space. But they do need to be big enough that you don't need to use chemicals to keep them going. Basically, they're clean. Unlike the fish farms of today, the salmon farms of Norway or Scotland or Canada, wherever, those farms, they pollute the local environment with feces from the fish, chemicals that the fish have been treated with, antibiotics, all that sort of stuff. So coastal aquaculture is not the answer. It is deep ocean aquaculture that is a clean, safe production system.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barisonic. My guest today is Julian Cribb, and we're talking about his book, How to Fix a Broken Planet. So a big obstacle to any of this is the fossil fuel industry, which is heavily subsidized. But to stop those subsidies and have people paying the real cost to the consumer and to the planet of those fossil fuels, we'd have to elect a government that isn't bought and paid for by the fossil fuel industry. And that gets to elections and item number 10 on the catastrophe list, mass delusions. How are mass delusions contributing to our problems?
So the trouble is that when you get people like the big oil giants spewing out misinformation from their lie factories, they're feeding the human species on a form of heroin that is very addictive but completely fallacious. They're lying for their own personal benefit, for their own profits, and for very short-term reasons. They are conspiring to kill their own grandchildren. But they do not care. And so are the governments that support them. And all our governments are in this boat, not just the American government. Even the Canadian government, the Norwegian government, and so on are tainted by fossil fuel influence. But as we switch more and more to renewable energy and renewable food, fossil fuels are just going to disappear. People are going to stop buying petrol. If you go to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf of Arabia, they're all into sunlight and wind these days. They're putting their fossil oil money into renewable energy. Why? Because they can see that fossil oil has got a limited lifespan. It's being replaced by other forms of energy. China is big time into hydrogen at the moment, as well as wind and sun. China is electrifying its economy at a phenomenal rate. 40%, I think, of their electricity now comes from renewables. So they're an example of a country that really has got the wind under their tail, and they're going for it. To be honest with you, that will bankrupt America in the long run. If America keeps on using Victorian technology to run its industries, those industries are all going to go broke. It will be forced to change. And America's got some terrific renewable technology. Make no mistake, the Americans are world leaders when it comes to coming up with good renewable technologies. But at the moment, you've got a regime that doesn't like them because it's trying to make the billionaires in the oil industry a little bit richer. But hopefully, American voters will come to their senses and realize that their future is being sold down the river by this regime.
There's a lot of misinformation going around. You have this pegged as one of the possible catastrophes. Do you think it's just because of what we've seen recently? And how does AI play into that?
I'll have to deal with that in two parts. First of all, misinformation. Basically, as I say, a society that lies to itself about what its problems are and how to fix them is a society that is never going to fix its problems. So misinformation is deadly. Misinformation is actually murder. If we think of COVID, all the anti-mask and anti-vaccine lobbying that went on was basically people demanding the right to kill their fellow citizens by spreading disease. They forgot all the lessons that we've learned in the past 100 years about vaccines and prevention of disease. They threw that away and said, it's not convenient to me. I don't want to wear a mask or I don't want to get a vaccine. Therefore, I don't mind if I kill my child, my aunt, my grandmother, somebody else by spreading the disease to them. We're way back to the start of the 19th century, pre-Civil War era in medical thinking, when you go with that line of thought. America is perhaps one of the very few developed countries in the world where life expectancy is currently starting to decline. And that is as a result chiefly of a failing health system. Even though it's the world's best in technology and science, it's no longer good enough for the people. And compared to the Scandinavian or the British health system or the Australian health system, you're nowhere, because all our citizens have access to good health care. And in most cases, it's free. America is putting itself further and further behind the eight ball. If you take vaccines out of the picture and you take other forms of therapy out of the picture, you're going to increase American death rates, and particularly among children. So I think that the death rate among children will be noticeable to the average person in the population quite soon. Take measles and mumps and whooping cough vaccine away, more kids are going to die. And that will be observable in the statistics in very little time. And everywhere, parents in America will become very anxious and very angry.
One of the solutions proposed in the book is a sort of bureau of fact-checking. You envisioned this as something that would be worldwide. How would that work?
Well, basically, somebody like the United Nations would establish an independent bureau or commission to check the facts of anybody in power or position of high influence, like Rupert Murdoch, for example. They would assess whether this person was telling the truth or not, in the same way that the New York Times keeps account of Trump's misinformation, or the Washington Post. There are two papers that do fact-checking as a matter of course on American politicians. All that they would do is report. So if the King of Saudi Arabia starts telling lies, if Vladimir Putin starts telling lies, if Premier Xi starts telling lies, the job of this commission would be to investigate, find out what the truth is, and report that this chap is a liar. Hold them up to public shame. No more serious penalty than that. Humans have to be able to know whether or not they can trust their leaders. And if you expose to them an untrustworthy leader who continuously lies about things, eventually that leader will be demolished, I believe, by most reasonable human societies.
Yes, you would think so. But what's going on in the United States is the opposite case. The man lies over and over again, and yet he's still in power, and he seems to be gaining more power. How would you keep this bureau from being compromised? There's a lot of scientific studies that are compromised because they're tainted by the industry and that sort of thing. How would you keep this kind of bureau of fact-checking from being tainted the same way?
I would do it the same way that you keep the International Court of Justice in The Hague. You appoint the world's best justices. In this case, you'd probably appoint the world's best philosophers or ethicists to such a commission. And you sack them if they're caught taking bribes or cheating. You can't guarantee truth, but you can clean up an awful lot of the rubbish that is being told to people. Now, let me just explain what I see. I'm a journalist, right? A newspaper editor from my background. What is going on in America? Americans have always had a strong resentment of central government, and that goes right the way back to the Boston Tea Party. And before that, in fact, most people came to America because they didn't want central government. There's always been this bubbling anger towards Washington and central government of all kinds in America. But what happened basically in the 70s, 80s, 90s is that suddenly the number of people who are prepared to believe conspiracy theories and lies started to expand. And people like Rupert Murdoch suddenly discovered there's a market out there for lies. I can make myself the richest media baron in America just by telling lies, because there's 80 million Americans who like listening to lies because it feeds their resentment of central government or their jealousy or their envy or whatever it is, their hatred for another racial group, ethnic group. There actually has always been a market for lies in human commerce. But it is exaggerated at the moment in the United States. I think Trump is going to make such a god-awful mess of the US and in particular its economy, but also its health and its occupational safety and things like that, that basically he will be swept away by history and Americans will come to their senses. I trust America to come to their senses. Winston Churchill said, "Americans always find the right answer after exhausting all the possible alternatives," which I think is quite a clever way of framing it. Americans had to have the flirtation with Trump and the MAGA movement just to see how bad things could really be. And I think that it's an inspirational country in many ways. It'll realize it's made an error. It'll swing the steering wheel in the opposite direction pretty hard, is my expectation. I hope I'm right. I hope you don't go down the fascist rabbit hole, but it's possible.
It's not looking good at this particular time. I'm curious, you don't see the same kind of buy into conspiracies in Australia that we're seeing in the US?
We get most of our conspiracies from you. You're the great conspiracy generators in the USA. So ours are kind of mostly secondhand. I don't know of any really large conspiracies in Australia that are homegrown, to be honest with you. It's mostly the who shot JFK type conspiracy that comes into Australia from the USA, because the USA has such powerful organs of communication, social media, media, and so on. And we're very closely aligned with US communication, Hollywood, all of that sort of stuff. So you're contaminating our public discourse, if you don't mind my saying that. But I think Australians are cool enough not to be swayed too much by it. We've got a small, tiny little rabble of 1% of the population that loves this kind of stuff. But they're not significant politically, and they're never going to have power over here. We're a democracy, and we're going to stay that way. And the same would apply in New Zealand. I think Britain has got a real problem. I'm an Englishman originally, and I think England is really in a lot of trouble. They had Brexit, which was founded on lies, for example. So they had their own conspiracy around Brexit because they just didn't like the Continentals. It's as simple as that. Britain has always feared and hated people who lived in Europe. And that goes back for 2,000 years. It just took hold of the country. And as a result, they've got a pretty rotten lot of politicians now. Conspiracy theories are rife in all societies. The conspiracy theories in Russia, for example, and elsewhere. So America is by no means alone. But America, because of its love of media and entertainment and storytelling, America is the undoubted world leader of conspiracy.
Yeah.
To save our grandchildren on a habitable planet.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Julian Cribb, and we've been talking about his book, How to Fix a Broken Planet. Julian, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.